Please welcome Vice President of the Woodstock Institute, Spencer Cowan.
Good morning. Thank you to the sponsors for inviting me. And I want to thank some very nice people at Georgia Tech and the Haas Institute for providing me data that I could steal and use in this presentation. Very nice of them. Ordinarily, I will start with a joke. Today, I will start with a disclaimer. The opinions I'm going to express are mine. They are not to be construed as those of any organization with which I am now or ever have been affiliated, which does include the University of Florida, where I got my master's. I was asked to provide some context for the negative equity discussion today, which means I'm the bad news department. Hate to rain on anybody's parade, but I look at this and I look at context as the broader picture. Where does the negative equity situation fit with other symptoms of neighborhood distress? And the extent of the problem, how bad is it? Most of my research is centered in Chicago because that's where Woodstock Institute is. And so the broader picture, I will look at Chicago. But Chicago is not that badly representative of a lot of other major urban areas, including Atlanta. I will use some data from Atlanta, which, as I said, thanks to Georgia Tech and the Haas Institute, and then talk a little bit about the policy implications. Negative equity is a symptom of neighborhood distress. It does not occur in isolation. It is not an isolated phenomenon. It is part of a pattern of distress that includes disinvestment, long-term vacancies, foreclosures, predatory lending. And these symptoms are not randomly distributed, and they are not random outcomes of the market. In my opinion, they are the result of past practices and policies and current practices and policies that reinforce housing patterns that we see correlated with symptoms of neighborhood distress. Patterns like redlining, racially restrictive covenants, exclusionary zoning that zones out people. And these reinforce and perpetuate the patterns that we see. This is looking at data from Chicago. On my right, your left, and by the way, I'm directionally challenged. I can say left and point that direction. And it's genetic, my daughter has it. You can see the concentration of the African American community in the Chicago region. On your right, my left, you see the pattern of long-term vacancies. And you can see how nicely they line up. This pattern is repeated in foreclosure activity, in patterns of foreclosures and auctions. This is not a coincidence. Communities of color were the targets of predatory lending because they were underserved by mainstream financial institutions. To look at the phenomena, to look at the way the patterns played out in Chicago, we did an analysis of negative equity to see how that lined up. Would it follow the same patterns? We received proprietary data. We merged it with census data to look at what the patterns were with respect to the racial makeup of the zip code. Not surprisingly, it certainly didn't surprise either my research associate or me, there seems to be a pattern. The higher the minority population in a zip code, the greater percentage of properties that are underwater, and the more severe the negative equity was. Overall, in the Chicago six-county region, we found about just under $25 billion aggregate negative equity, and about a quarter of all homeowners as of the end of the fourth quarter, 2011. In predominantly white zip codes, it was about 17%. And the About 10% had a loan-to-value ratio greater than 110%. In predominantly minority zip codes, over 40% of homeowners were underwater, and over 30% were more than 10% were 110% underwater. In some zip codes, the average equity was negative. They actually owed more throughout the entire zip code than their properties were worth. We also looked at equity just to see how that played out, because of course, that's the flip side. And as you can see, again, pretty much the same pattern. In predominantly white zip codes, the average equity was about $108,000. The average loan-to-value ratio was about 67%. In zip codes that were 80% or more African-American, the average equity was $6,800. That's it. That's the average equity, with an average loan-to-value ratio of over 92%. This is very tenuous. People are very close to being underwater if they're not part of that 40% who were underwater. And we've heard about the recovery, and we see the Case-Shiller price index going up in the Chicago region, and that's wonderful. And I have to remind people that what happens on the lakefront, what happens where I live in the northern suburbs, has nothing to do with what's happening in the south and west sides, where people are hurting. You can see the recovery. You can see how we haven't come all the way back, but in predominantly white zip codes, the home value index is up. It's almost nearly recovered. In predominantly minority zip codes, they're lagging. So people who were behind, who fell even further behind in the recession and in the foreclosure crisis, are falling even further behind, as they are not, their neighborhoods are not recovering in Chicago. And I would expect in a lot of other metro areas. But I'm in Atlanta. And as you can see from this map from the Haas Institute, it's easy to pick out Chicago, where hardest hit zip codes are, and it's pretty easy to pick out Atlanta. And if I look hard, I can pick out Detroit and Cleveland. We share a distinction. We are centers of negative equity. People at Georgia Tech did a study very recently, shows the pattern for the home value index before, during, and after the bubble. The blue line shows neighborhoods. These are predominantly more affluent neighborhoods with average home values about $187,000, about 13.5% African American, that had some run up during the bubble, some fall during the recession. They have recovered. They are back to higher than even the housing bubble. The orange line, these are more moderate neighborhoods, average home value about $120,000, about 36% African American, where the values didn't go up as far, but then they went way down. But now they've started to come back up. They haven't fully recovered, but they're getting there. And then you have neighborhoods averaging about 64% African American, average home value about 91,000, had the biggest run up during the bubble. That's the gray line. They fell. They didn't fall quite as far as those middle neighborhoods, but they are not recovering. They are still underwater. If you bought a home in those neighborhoods after the turn of the millennium, you are underwater, most likely. This shows the distribution. I'm not familiar with the Atlanta region. I'm from Chicago. I've been here a few times, but not often. Flew through here a lot. I used to live in Chapel Hill. But you can see the outline of the city of Atlanta. A lot of the hard-hit zip codes are there. Susan asked me to use the word, and I'm going to. I looked at the data from the Haas Institute on the 395 hardest hit zip codes in the United States, and I was shocked when I looked at them. 9 out of the 10 hardest hit are in the Atlanta region, 16 out of the hardest 20, and half of the top fit or bottom, depending on how you want to look at it, 50. That shocked me. I thought there would be some distribution. I didn't expect Atlanta to be that seriously affected. In those 25 hardest hit zip codes, the negative percent of homeowners with negative equity is up to 76%. 3 out of 4 plus Gator math. 24 of those 25 are majority African American or Hispanic, and 19 are 80% or more African American or Hispanic, and they have a combined population of over 839,000 people. I don't know how big the Metro Atlanta region is, but that's a lot of people who are hurting, who have problems, who need help. And if that's not enough, think of the negative impacts. And I'm just picking some of them. I haven't got time to go through the whole list. It drives foreclosure. If you are seriously underwater on your mortgage, at some point, well, the easy ones, people who just bought for business, who did it strictly as an investment, they probably strategically defaulted already if they were seriously underwater, because that's just, they're never going to get a return on investment. You cut your losses. But for homeowners, people living there, it's not just an economic decision. That's their home. They are trapped. They are trapped in a situation. If they see their income decrease, they know they can't afford the mortgage anymore. What strategy do they have? They cannot get out. They can't sell and downsize the way they would in a rising housing market. They dip into savings, they exhaust their savings, they exhaust their retirement, and they still can't pay. It drives foreclosure. It limits opportunity. If you are underwater on your mortgage and you get a job offer in another city, I was living in Chapel Hill, got a job offer in Chicago, no problem, I can move. If I'm underwater, I can't do that. I can't take that better job. And it reduces the incentive to maintain the property. This is an investment. It's not worth what I paid for it. Why should I put more money into it? I can barely afford the mortgage now. I don't have money to maintain the property. And that affects neighborhood property values. If I'm looking for a home and I find one, real estate agent shows me a nice home, and 2 doors down, I see a home with peeling paint, a broken railing on the front stoop, badly maintained, that's ugly. I don't want to live in that neighborhood. I'm going to find somewhere else. So it does have spillover effects. Blight, it increases blight, and blight has spillover effects. So what can we do? What are some of the solutions? And if I look at negative equity, my first thought is it's very simple. We need to get people out of negative equity situations. Principal reductions. They are proven effective. They work. Unfortunately, FHFA doesn't permit Fannie and Freddie to do principal reductions. And they hold the majority of mortgages, at least in Chicago, and I would expect in Atlanta. That leaves lender initiatives. If lenders are willing to accept a deed in lieu, which is where the homeowner just deeds over the house, walks away, and the lender agrees not to go after them for the deficiency, the difference between what the property is worth and what they owe, or a short sale where they can find a buyer who is willing to pay something less than what the mortgage is, and the bank is willing, the lender is willing to accept that. There are limited options. HAMP refinances, to a certain extent, help, But what they do is defer part of the principal. They don't waive the principal. You still owe that money. You still have the same problem. If you want to sell, unless it's worth more than what you owe, you've either got to get the lender to agree to a short sale or something's going to happen. And now, the early HAMP mortgage refinances, the rates are beginning to reset. They're beginning to reset to levels that are unaffordable for some people. And redefaults are climbing. So the good news about the decline in foreclosure filings may unfortunately be short-lived. And then we have something that's somewhat aside, home equity lines of credit, or what we call HELOCs. A lot of those were written where for 10 years you could pay interest only. But then after 10 years, you had to start paying off principal as part of the amortization. And a lot of those were written at the start of the housing bubble. And a lot of those now are starting to require higher payments. So again, not only are we dealing with negative equity, we're dealing with this entire layering of threats to homeownership and to neighborhood stability. Thank you. I hope I haven't been too depressing. And I was told to ask if there are any questions. I really did bum you out, didn't I? Yes. Illinois has done a lot with the hardest hit fund. Cook County has its foreclosure mediation program. We provide data on properties that are going into foreclosure to neighborhood groups to help them reach out to homeowners. And so we try to the community groups try to intervene, get people to go into mediation to resolve cases. I don't know what percentage of people actually do. It's been considered fairly successful. It has diverted a lot of people. It's resolved a lot of cases. Now, resolving doesn't always mean the homeowner keeps the property. If you are in a mortgage that you really can't afford, stalling the foreclosure process may not be good for you because it just continues to damage your credit. It's not good for the neighborhood because your property is deteriorating. So we try to, or the community groups try to work to get the best resolution for you, understanding that that may be a graceful exit. So if you'd like afterwards, I will try to talk with you and give you some more information about the groups that are actually doing the work, like Southwest Organizing Project or the Northwest Side Housing Center. And we work a lot with them. We don't tend to work with people directly in the community. We work with the groups that do. Any other questions?
Right here.
Yes.
You mentioned policy implications just based on the fact that of the nationally the 50 highest zip codes and then 25 in Atlanta. You mentioned policy implications. I'm just wondering if you also have any regulatory implications to suggest. Recognizing our friends in the room.
I would like to, first of all, I would love to see FHFA permit principal reductions. I would like to see more community groups able to intervene in the foreclosure process, but I'm not as familiar with your local regulatory framework beyond the Fannie and Freddie issue. I would like to see Congress make permanent the tax relief for forgiven principal, which seems to be a year-to-year thing, because if your lender forgives principal in a principal reduction, that's taxable income. So they write off $50,000 worth of principal. You just have to report $50,000 worth of income, which you really didn't receive, but you probably owe $7,500 in taxes on that. So I look predominantly, I would like to see more programs to encourage servicers more strongly to engage in negotiation, especially when principal reduction would be net present value positive, that is, when the cash flow, even from the reduced mortgage, would be worth more than the property in foreclosure. Other questions?
It seems like a lot of the homeowners got blamed. Times were good. Homeowners, I think, trusted the system. And as you find out kind of what happened, it seemed like all the big banks, Chase, Bank of America, at the same time they were loaning to all these homeowners, were betting against themselves to fail, so they knew what was coming. But, you know, are any of those people ever going to be accountable, go to jail for their actions?
On the advice of counsel, I respectfully decline to answer. Unfortunately, as we look at the narrative and as we look at what happened, yes, there were lenders who preyed on people who were unsophisticated. But I've also testified in a mortgage fraud case where people willingly participated. So it's very easy for both sides to find anecdotes to support their view of reality. It's much more complicated. I personally, and this is completely personal, would love to see more accountability, more personal accountability across the board. I think it's unfortunate that there hasn't been. I think that would be the real disincentive to do this again. But I'm not optimistic. Any others? Thank you very much.